I didn't hate it at all. which, if you know me, that's actually pretty high praise for a Microsoft product.
This is Up, Up, Down, Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, a 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision, is now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us today is Jeff LaMarche. Jeff is founder of Martian Craft and an author of multiple books on iOS and Mac development. Jeff is currently leading the team making the upcoming game Republic Sniper. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. So inspired by a recent excellent blog post by Jeff on the Martian Craft website, on Martian Craft blog, we're talking today about game engines, what they can give us or you out there building games, and what the trade-offs are in between the various engines that are available and sort of what goes into evaluating them. So I think to kick things off, a good initial question is for those of us who are not game developers or are developers, but not specifically for games, what are the key things that a game engine gives you? Because we've had an episode about sort of the lower level APIs, like are you using OpenGL or are you using Metal? But this is a higher level thing. So what do you get in a game engine anyway?
Well, definitely the most important thing you get with a game engine is a starting point that's not a blank editor window. You know, a game engine gives you a head start on the whole process. You can spend a huge amount of time at the beginning of development getting all your ducks in a row, you know, figuring out, all right, what is our asset pipeline going to look like? How are we going to make models and get them into the game? What is our rendering technology going to be? What is our physics technology going to be? And a game engine basically lets you short circuit a lot of that and start from a point where most of the basic stuff is running and you can start building your game right away, as opposed to having to spend, you know, 6 months or a year or more in some cases building all of that kind of fundamental technology. So, I mean, that's sort of the biggest advantage that a game engine gives you in terms of the specifics of what you get sort of tech wise. It varies from engine to engine, but minimally these days you're going to get some sort of rendering engine, some kind of physics system, some, you know, technology able that kind of gameplay modeling, you know, a way of scripting objects or some way of, you know, putting together object components to build your logic, you know, basic stuff like sound, output, input, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Like that's the technology that's sort of there in a game engine.
And so basically the stuff that's going to be in any game, regardless, more or less, you know, most games are going to have some amount of physics. The most games are going to want to put models of objects on the screen at some point. So rather than reinventing that wheel, you get a base to sort of build from.
Yeah, it usually includes editor, a visual editor for the various types of things that you have to do that are more visual, like designing a map is something that's kind of hard to do in a text editor, or, you know, it also includes a lot of essentially what, you know, those of us working outside of game engines and like Xcode would think of as static or shared libraries for common functionality, like loading a model or playing a sound.
So in similar, actually, for people who are from other types of development, it would generally be called a framework. You know, if you're building a website, you're not just going to start with like some plain empty Ruby file. You're going to probably bring in something like Rails that's going to just, you know, allow you to do things like put a web page up, and then you kind of go from there. So historically, back in the day, a lot of studios built their own game engines. And more, partially because of the transition to indie games, partially because, you know, technology is not changing as fast as it used to. It seems like game engines are becoming more like licensing a game engine that already exists rather than building your own seems to be more and more the common thing that studios are doing. And the two big ones that, at least sort of from talking to people who are in sort of indie developers and medium-sized developers that are considering and talking about game engine technology, the two that tend to come up are Unity and Unreal Engine. Unity being sort of the more commonly used by indies, and then Unreal being sort of an engine from the history of bigger AAA games. So do you want to tell us a little bit, Jeff, about first kind of like where Unity fits into the world and kind of what led you to originally start building your game on it?
Sure. Well, you know, I don't know, you know, all of Unity's history going back, but I know that, you know, where they sort of caught on and really sort of grabbed the bull by its horns and took the lead, at least in the smaller shops in the indies, was they were one of the first engines to really hop on board the iPhone and iOS and to
right.
To find a, you know, to provide a way to create apps using their tool that could run on the iPhone and then later the iPad. And that was actually kind of a big deal because Apple, although they've loosened up much more now, they used to be really tightly controlling on the App Store, and they didn't really want you working outside of Xcode. In fact, the Unity workflow is still to go from the Unity editor to export out to an Xcode project, and then to launch Xcode to actually build your game to run on a device. So that was where it sort of started to pick up, and they at some point went basically free for the basic edition, and I think that sort of lowered the obstacles to entry for a lot of people. So a lot of people decided to check it out rather than trying to code it on their own. And you know, that's I think where they really sort of took off was, you know, the pro version. I think it's about $1,500 back before they went to the subscription licensing, which, you know, it sounds like a fair amount of money, but, you know, if you're paying programmers and stuff, it doesn't really take a lot of programmer hours to make that back. And it, you know, it does provide a lot.
Yeah, well, that's a roughly equivalent to the cost of like Photoshop or something like that. Whereas my understanding is that if you wanted to license like the sort of Doom engine, or maybe that's a bad example, but one of the sort of big FPS engines for AAA games 10 or 15 years ago, then they wouldn't even talk to someone like us, let alone just sell it to us for $1,500.
The Doom engine is actually a pretty good example because that was one of the first like what we'd think of as a game engine. Prior to it, virtually all games just built all of what you'd consider their engine technology from scratch, with maybe, you know, the occasional bit of small sub-licensed technology, like, you know, a mod player to play back music or, you know, like a video codec if you were doing streaming video or something like that. But Doom was actually one of the first games that was built initially to have the ability to sort of bolt content in new, and so it became a real playground for modders. And then also other games started getting built on top of the same the same basis. I don't think Doom was heavily licensed to third parties. Like, you couldn't just sort of call them up and say, hey, we want to get a Doom license, but they definitely found a few partners for it and did a couple games with it. Heretic is one that I know that was sort of a high profile one that was done on a slightly modified version of the Doom engine. So Doom actually did kind of kick off the whole trend in many ways. And then the, you know, id's next engine, the Quake engine, was kind of the one that really kicked it into high gear. Like, it was the first engine that just kind of, you know, they would sell it to anyone, basically. You know, you just called them up and got a quote and shipped them the money, and they shipped you the source code, which was pretty unusual at that time.
But my understanding, again, correct me if I'm wrong, Nigel, was that, you know, in the sort of heyday of these big AAA games in the PlayStation 1, PlayStation 2 era, if I wanted one of these cutting-edge game engines for my hobby project, I wouldn't be able to just go online and be like, oh yeah, I'd like to, or call them up and be like, hey, yeah, so like, I'm making this game with a budget of like $50,000, so what, can I pay you like maybe $5,000 and get your whole 3D game engine?
No, definitely not. It was the beginning of game engine licensing, but it wasn't the beginning of accessible game engine licensing. That, you know, we were still talking hundreds of thousands of dollars to get in on the ground floor on one of those things.
Yeah, and that was after you paid for your console development kits and everything. It was, you know, a lot of money to even consider it. So it just wasn't something a hobbyist could really do at all.
Or even like a medium-sized studio. You really need a publishing deal where, you know, someone's like, okay, here's a giant truck full of money that you're going to actually spend like a huge portion of it before you even write a line of code in order to just be in the club of people who can make games like this.
No, what the hobbyist market was definitely doing at that time was mods. You know, that was where that piece of creative energy was getting funneled into, is people just doing free add-ons for games they like. And it was, you know, that was a hard thing to monetize, because you're always in a bit of a legal gray area with the original creators. You know, most of them were happy to have the mods out there as long as, you know, as long as there weren't any of those issues. But as soon as someone starts charging money, then suddenly the issues of content reuse and ownership and stuff like that become a lot, you know, a lot more problematic. It's the same sort of thing as, like, you know, the relationship between published authors and fan fiction, right? That it's a sign of a healthy ecosystem when it's free, but as soon as people start charging money, then lawyers get involved and things get nasty very quickly.
They don't want you making millions of dollars from your Harry Potter questionable fan fiction stuff on Amazon.
Yeah, I think Valve is actually sort of the one that bucked the trend a little bit there. A number of their titles are ones that started out as mods. Counter-Strike was a mod. The original Team Fortress was a Quake mod, if I remember correctly. But most
Portal,
of
I think, was Narbacular Drop. Wasn't that also a mod of some sort? Half-Life?
I think so.
Yeah. So a number of their titles have actually been, but I think, you know, they're sort of the exception, not the rule in the industry. You don't see a lot of the companies embracing for pay or monetized, mods. But you do see a lot of them encouraging the modding, because, you know, that really gets the fans invested in the engine and continuing, you know, keeps, I mean, Oblivion, which is, I don't know, what is it, 6, 7, 8 years now, still has a very active modding community out there. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, and there are some modern games like StarCraft 2 has like a mod, sort of like a quite healthy mod community inside the game, where you can like upload your mods and you can download them and it manages them, and there's updates and ratings and stuff like that, which is definitely a far cry from, say, the Minecraft modding community, where you need to download some horrible Java thing and patch it into this mess. So game engines. So Unity comes along, and it's the underdog, and it's this sort of scrappy thing that allows you. And my first exposure to Unity was that you could have this browser plugin where it was like this C++ thing, and then you could have games in the browser. And this is before WebGL or anything, which I rolled my eyes at, because I'm like, no one's going to install a plugin. This Unity thing's a fad. And I was very wrong, because...
Well, you were right in that the web player did kind of turn out to be a bit of a fad. Like, that's not how Unity caught on. That was certainly their original plan, and the web player's still out there, but it's never been the success for them, as far as I can tell, that the engine licensing is. It certainly didn't achieve their original goal of being the Flash for 3D games, which I think was kind of their original plan.
Right, and I believe, actually, and I'm not 100% sure of this, but that people deploy Unity games in a Flash bundle even today, where, you know, there's like a Flash Unity runtime. Either you know for sure whether or not that's true?
I don't know.
I believe there is, and I don't remember if it's an add-on, because we never looked to use it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Flash is still the way of the past, but the Unity thing that they really sort of, and you alluded to it, Jeff, was that they had this free license, which is basically, or at least it is today, and probably similar when it first started, which was that if your company is under a certain size, which they say is like under $100,000 a year of revenue, basically, then you can just use this free version of Unity that has a lot of the features and just go have fun. And then if you grow up and you start actually making revenue and you want some of the more advanced features of graphics and stuff like that, then you pay their thing, which is like now $75 a month or $1,500 up front or whatever, comparable to something like Photoshop or maybe Microsoft Office. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Republic Sniper and sort of digging in and how you got started on that with Unity?
Well, sure. I mean, I guess when we started, actually, and the idea for the game actually goes quite a ways back, but we started actually doing real day-to-day work on it about a year ago. And really, a year ago, there really weren't a lot of options that we would consider. I mean, we looked around, but we knew we wanted to do it as a 3D game. We were still exploring the game types and various things, but we knew we wanted it to be 3D. And so, you know, we looked around at what was available, and, you know, I don't think Torque ever went to ever got their stuff over to mobile. Ogre 3D is just this really user unfriendly thing. It's, you know, it's powerful, but you know, it actually feels a lot like modding somebody else's engine when you're working in it. I mean, it's just, you know, it looked like there was a lot of obstacles. There was Scio 3D that we looked at, but you know, that was limited in terms of the platforms it supported. And so, you know, kind of when you looked at the field a year ago, it really was Unity way out ahead of the pack. I mean, there wasn't, because they supported the Mac and Windows, and I think they even had started on Linux support at the time. They had Android, they had iOS, they had Windows Phone already, which, I mean, nobody supports Windows Phone hardly. You know, I mean, they have console licenses available. You have to pay for them separately and negotiate them separately. But, you know, it's this incredible number of platforms that they support. And, you know, with the exception of things like the in-app purchase and things that are just inherently platform specific, it's all very portable. You write it on one platform and it needs very little or no modification to bring to another platform. So, you know, it provides you with most of the basics that you need. I mean, you can, if you've got a 3D model that you can drop in there, you can, you know, you can have something running the first day of coding. Not necessarily something that looks good or that's fun to play, but you can actually have something visual that works. And that's, I think that's a really valuable thing just in terms of motivation, you know, that you fire it up and the first day you've got something that you can see and that you can show people and talk about.
And that's dramatically different from what if you just had like a PlayStation 3 dropped on your desk, Nigel, back in the day. I remember you telling a story of like just getting the first triangle showing up on the screen was definitely not the first day.
No, that was like a month in. You got a rendering engine cobbled together to get the first triangle on screen.
Yeah. And then things move faster after that. It's not like a month per triangle, but so Unity gets you started quickly, and definitely at that time when you started a year ago, it was the engine that made sense. And sort of reading through what you were writing about it, it was a good start, but it started kind of getting in your way in various ways.
Yeah, well, we started actually coming up with the concepts for the game. I think the entire company was 8 or 10 people. By the time we actually started writing code for it, we were considerably larger, and you know, we got more ambitious, we got more sort of demanding of ourselves of what we were looking to put out. We didn't want to put out something simple, we didn't want to put out we wanted to keep the scope of the game down so that we could, you know, really focus on the polish and make it look good. And as we started pushing that, we brought in some game artists. Actually, they weren't game artists when we brought them in. They were we stole them from the visual effects industry, but they very quickly became game artists. But what we found is that the workflow around Unity really didn't scale well as we started to ramp up the team, as we started to try and push the capabilities of the at that time new 64-bit iOS hardware, and you know, just it we found ourselves with lots of little frustrations, you know, death by a million paper cuts. There wasn't any one thing keeping us from doing a job. It's not like it was a bad tool. It's just, it kind of felt like it was working against us a little bit after a while, after we got past the early prototyping stages. It was great early on when it was basically me programming and the you know, artists were off on their side coming up with models and doing concept art and stuff. But as you know, we added more programmers, as we started actually trying to integrate everything together and to get a workflow established that would let us, you know, get the game created, you know, we found ourselves getting pretty frustrated, and the artists really just were sort of the crux of it. They really didn't like any time they had to go into the Unity editor.
Which is a bad sign, because you want the artists directly implementing game content if you possibly can, rather than having programmers do it.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It became kind of a big bottleneck, especially in the early days of the project when I was the principal programmer. Every time that they wanted to tweak the visual look, the overall look and feel of the app, it would be me going in and tweaking the shaders, or, you know, me taking what they had done and then sending them a build so they could play around with it. And then they would come back to me and say, oh, no, it needs more specular. And, you know, they might have to go and tweak their map, or they might have to tell me to tweak the some setting. Or it was this really kind of onerous workflow at the time. You know, and it was at times kind of frustrating.
And you're reluctant to say that Unity is a bad tool, but when you say that they didn't have a 64-bit, is that correct? They didn't have a 64-bit app, like editor app,
that is,
in 2014?
That is correct. The first 64-bit version, I think, are the Unity 5 betas that are available to a small subset of their developers now, people on their beta list. They still don't have a release version out that's 64-bit.
And 64-bit Max came out, I believe, in 2007?
2006. Apple 2006, shipped the last 32-bit only. 2007, some of them were 32-64. But the last 32-only machine, I think, shipped in 2006.
Was certainly, like, at Radical, several years before I left in 2010, we'd done the transition of moving to the 64-bit versions of all the content tools that we use, like the high-end stuff like Maya and that, right? That we were already, you know, a larger software developer, but probably from an art standpoint, our, you know, some of our models and stuff like that were on the same scale of what indie games are working with now in those days. And yeah, I mean, our artists were just chomping at the bit to get like a 64-bit build of Maya in like 2006, 2007, right? Like, you know, the fact that you can be in a situation in 2014 where you're not using 64-bit tools is just crazy.
Especially because that's like pretty much the only thing that 64-bit really matters for. Like, you know, you being able to use more than 4 gigabytes of memory and like, okay, yeah, basically pro apps like Photoshop, maybe like Logic and things like that, Pro Tools maybe, but like it's pretty much a poster child of 64-bit apps.
Yeah, and I think it's really one of those places where, you know, their decision to support so many platforms and to have feature parity with the Windows editor and the Mac editor, I think that actually may be where it hurt them, because they probably weren't thinking ahead. I mean, I know even with some of the small projects that we on the iOS side, because you know, for years that was, they went back to 32-bit for the mobile stuff, and then when the 64 stuff kicked in, it was like, well, if you've been, you know, following development guidelines, it'll just work. And of course it doesn't just work, you know, you have to go through and find where you made assumptions about the bit width of your int and whatever. And so I'm guessing that it had something to do with the fact that they've got this Windows editor, and the Microsoft didn't handle the 32 to 64-bit transition quite as well as Apple did, generally speaking. And I know there's most games today still ship as 32-bit apps.
You know, Apple's famously good at transitioning between architectures and things like that. Maybe the Unixiness of their operating system is a bit of a cheat code, but it's something they tend to do pretty well.
Well, that and Steve Jobs sort of notorious not wanting to have to rely on anybody. You know, all the stories of them keeping Intel builds of OS X running during all those early versions in a secret lab and stuff. You know, they were always paranoid about getting, you know, sort of screwed over by a partner. So,
and turns out that it worked.
Yeah.
So you started building the game on Unity. You're having these sort of various, like, that editors not being able to use enough memory, and the workflows frustrating your artists and things like that. And so was it kind of like the whole time you knew that Unreal was out there, or how did that sort of transition go? Not to, like, spoiler alert the story, but...
Well, there was, for a lot of the time, it really wasn't a viable option. There was UDK, and UDK was available, was able to create iOS games, because all along, although, you know, we've been kind of flexible, but, you know, iOS has really sort of been our reference platform. We have intended and still intend to support multiple platforms, but we want to ship first on iOS and make that our reference. And so, you know, the UDK would do it, but you had to work in Windows. The tools were all Windows based, but then, of course, because iOS apps had to be built on a Mac, you had this sort of workflow where you had to do your day-to-day work on a Windows machine, and then you had to export it over, and then you had to actually do your build on the Mac. And it just, you know, most of us, our game artists are mostly Windows guys. We've got a couple of other people in the company who use Windows. But, you know, 85% of us, maybe even a little higher than that, you know, are given the choice, people who are going to work on a Mac all day. And so I never really considered it in the UDK days, primarily because I didn't want to work on Windows all day long. You know, really what it came down to. And then I was also a little sort of scared of their previous licensing fee. They had gone from the old Unreal, you know, individually negotiated AAA, you know, licenses that could be 50,000 a seat or more, to this free, but you had to pay 25% of your gross after the first 50,000. And when you throw that 25% on top of the 30% that Apple or Google are already getting on from the store fee, you know, you're losing over 50% of your gross, and that was sort of scary and off-putting. Also, so those were the two things that sort of kept us from considering the UDK, and that was really the only kind of big boy alternative to Unity if you were targeting iOS during most of our early development.
And that's to give some people some context when we talk about Unreal. It is something where it was on iOS in the, I don't know, not immediately, but in the fairly early days, if you saw those Infinity Blade demos up at WWDC when they were announcing whichever new GPU it was at that time, that was one of the first Unreal engine games on iOS. And if anyone has played like console games like BioShock, Mass Effect, Deus Ex, Arkham Asylum, like there's a ridiculous number of games out there that are built with Unreal. So it's this like sort of tantalizing thing that has obviously great power, but you know, when the math would mean that you're giving up more than half of your revenue in order to use it, it's maybe not very appealing.
Yeah, it's not that it wasn't appealing. It was just it was scary, and you know, and you have to make decisions about, you know, things, and when you're looking at the bottom line, you're saying, you know, well, we don't know if we're going to make any money to begin with, you know, or make back our investment. So, you know, we've got to try and maximize that. So it was kind of an option we knew was out there, but just really one that didn't seem viable for us, really up until just, when did they come out with I can't even remember when they announced the 1999, the new licensing.
It was in the spring sometime.
March, maybe.
I think it might have been the GDC.
That would make sense.
Yeah, maybe GDC one was that, like March or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, here it is. It looks like it was in March.
And so, yeah, when that came out and at the, you know, they announced the beta version of the Mac editor, all of a sudden it was like, that was, which actually happened to hit the same time that we were working on lightmap bakes for this really large level that we do. We have this sort of training range, which is where you start, and then anytime you want to go back and upgrade your weapons, whatever, you can use this training range to try it out. Of course, it's a sniper range, so it's going to be kind of long. And so, you know, we had this really big map, and we just kept having all sorts of problems with the light map bakes, because not only do you have that theoretical 4 gig limit is actually considerably lower than that, because some of that memory is used for other things. So if you have a dual GPU system, which is what I was working with, you actually only had 2.7-ish, plus or minus, gigs to work with, and it was just constantly hitting it. It was frustrating. And so at the same time that we were hitting these really big frustrations with Unity being stuck in 32-bit world, not getting sort of stellar customer support from Unity over the issues, and then, you know, this comes out at the same time. It was kind of the perfect storm, and our artists really championed the cause of the Switch. And you know, I was looking at Unreal like, this is something I want to play with because it's available on the Mac and it looks amazing, but you know, the thought of throwing out 9 months of work or whatever and starting over really wasn't appealing to me early on.
I think it's almost impossible to like overstate what a big deal this new licensing model is. Like, I think even the day that it was announced, like I pointed out to Alan, and I was like, this is a game changer. It's kind of the equivalent of like, you know, Honda coming out and saying, like, here's our new mid-size sedan. It's, you know, it's $22,000 or whatever. And then Ferrari comes along and is like, yeah, we're going to sell you a Ferrari 548 for, like, the same amount of money.
Right.
And it really is, you know, like, Unreal and Unity previously were kind of operating on totally different levels of like performance and functionality, and the pricing reflected that. And then, you know, them coming along just saying like, yeah, we're going to license you. I think it's almost cheaper than Unity was at the time, though. Maybe they've since adjusted their licensing in some way.
Unreal is substantially cheaper than Unity Pro if you have a very small game, because their deal is $19 a month plus 5% of your gross revenue. So 5% of your gross revenue is less than $60 a month, which, you know, you hope it's not, but if it is, like, for a tiny, you know, indie game or whatever, then Unreal is actually kind of cheaper.
Well, and it's also, to look at it, the scaling is another interesting thing, because that 5% gross is on your product, not per seat. So you're paying $19 per seat, and then the 5% gross is going to be the same regardless of how big your team is. So, you know, they don't really scale the same way, because with Unity, you know, I'm paying at least that base professional license, 75 a month or 15 or 750. I don't even remember the flat rate, but you're paying that essentially per seat. And then for anyone who needs additional platforms, you know, if you need iOS, that's another 75 a month. You need Android, that's another $75 a month. You want to export out for consoles, give us a call. We'll give you a price for that. You know, so it's, you know, the pricing on the Unreal is I think Nigel's absolutely right. It's really a game changer, and it's kind of hard to believe they're doing it in a way. It's just like, wow. You know,
basically just completely pulling the rug out from underneath the Unity folks.
Well, you do. They, you know, another thing that Unity is very protective of is their source code. You want a source license, you know, they basically try and talk you out of it. And then if they can't talk you out of it, they give you a very, very high number. For that $19.95 a month, you get access to the Git repositories with all their source code. You can actually see their commits as they check them in and get ready to do a new release. You know,
okay, that's amazing.
That's absolutely amazing, especially things like the metal support. They weren't allowed to ship metal support, obviously, right after WWDC, but they could put it in their Git repo, and you could build your own copy with metal support. You know, it's amazing. You know, if there's a bug and you don't have time to wait for them to fix it, you can have a developer go in and fix the bug. It's.
Can you submit pull requests?
Yeah.
Yeah,
they make
so cool.
You a member of their organization on GitHub.
Okay, well, I didn't realize that. All right, that's just. Okay, so obviously Unreal is just amazing, and we should just build everything with Unreal, right?
And that's something that's a big deal for larger teams, for sure, is having the source access, right? Like, if you're doing a game small enough that you probably can't fix the engine if it breaks, you know, if you're like a 2 or 3 or 5 person shop, then, you know, then not having the source might be an inconvenience occasionally, but it's not a big deal. But for anyone larger, you know, having a source license be substantially different could be a real deal breaker, because once you hit a you know, scale of even like a large indie kind of game, like 20 or 30 people, you know, never mind something that's actually like hundreds of people working on it at like AAA scale, not having the source code for that underlying stuff is a huge pain in the butt. You know, it's it really has the potential to slow you down if you have to wait on new releases to get fixes to things.
Yes, well, and that was actually one of our frustrations with Unity was, you know, essentially you've got to lobby for, you know, if you need something fixed, especially, you know, if you're not encountering the same types of problems that the bulk of the Unity developer crowd is experiencing, you know, you're basically in a situation where they're not really motivated to fix your bugs, because you're just, you know, 1% You know, they're going to focus on the bugs that are being encountered by the 80%. So, you know, that was, we having to do all sorts of creative workarounds to problems because, you know, our bugs weren't getting fixed because they were kind of peculiar compared to, you know, most of the 2 and 3 person indie shops that is the I think the bulk of Unity's client base.
So you did basically saw all this, the writing was on the wall, you decided to dive in. Basically throwing away, you say throwing away, is it really throwing away 6 months of development work? Basically.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we didn't have to throw away the art, you know, any of the art stuff, although the rendering systems are fundamentally different. So it wasn't a direct, you couldn't just directly port them over. You had to do a lot of work on the materials and stuff, but you know, we didn't lose all the work that we did on models and textures. But you know, essentially the development work was pretty much gone. Now, when you start over, you're gaining, you know, you still have the experience, you know, you still know the algorithms, you know, it's not completely like going back and you know, starting with a vacant plot of land and having to build a whole new house, but it is a lot of do-over. It is a lot of work that you wouldn't have had to do otherwise. It's an investment.
But of course, when you do it the second time, it's all going to be better.
Well, that is true.
You're the expert in building that exact thing.
That is true.
So now you're sort of digging into Unreal, and obviously you wrote the post pretty recently, so you're feeling good about that decision. But is there any sort of downsides or issues that you're hitting now that you're in this sort of totally different environment other than needing to remake stuff?
Well, you know, I mean, these are complex tools. I mean, I'd be lying if I said we never encountered any issues at all. I certainly don't have any regrets to this point about the decision. It's been a very positive experience, and Epic has been really good about helping us when we have bugs. We've had a lot of our issues have actually been around the build process. And they've been very, very good about helping us out. You know, but there certainly are issues. There's a learning curve. You know, it's a completely different language. I mean, with UE4, there's now two options for programming. They've got this new visual language called Blueprint, and then they've got C++. Well, I haven't done C++ on a day-to-day basis in like a decade. So, you know, I'm getting back then. I'm trying to unthink Objective-C and the other languages I've done more recently and try to remember how the hell these, you know, C++ stuff works. And you know, so it there's a learning curve. There's, you know, figuring out how to do stuff the Unreal way. And, you know, I guess you can see that as bad or good. I think all the people that we have, at least on the technical side, but probably all the people we have on the project, period, like learning that stuff, like learning, you know, diving in, learning something new, learning cool things. And it's been really kind of a pleasant experience because being a tool that has been used by such demanding clients, you know, we're always finding so many kind of unexpected little surprises in there. You know, we started to work on the AI. We're working almost entirely in code in Unity for any kind of behavior stuff. And in Unreal, you know, we've got behavior trees, we've got a lot of these gaming best practices that have sort of been built into the tools, and it's been a very just positive experience. It hasn't been, you know, without bumps in the road. It hasn't been without difficulties or challenges, but it's been a very positive experience.
I often find with those tools, you know, it can be overwhelming. Like when you open up Photoshop, like if you're used to using something simpler like Acorn, and then you open up Photoshop, and you're like, what's all these crazy things? I don't even want to have to know about them, but like, if you don't know, like you mentioned, behavior trees, like if you're a game developer and you use this engine and there's this thing that has behavior trees and you don't know what those are, maybe you should know what they are. Like if they're in the engine, there's probably some reason to for them to be there. But you could probably spend a year just like reading the theory behind all these things that they help you do. You mentioned C++ as, you know, you haven't written C++ in a long time. Obviously, you know, as Mac developers, we spend a lot of our time writing Objective-C. But C++ is the most common game development language. In Unity, were you using the C# interface?
That's correct. We were using C#. We had a few bits of third-party code that were done in JavaScript, but I think by the time we abandoned ship, we had rewritten all of those in C#. So, yeah, pretty much everything that we did was C#.
So then that's going to be a part of why you need to rewrite.
Right.
Stuff.
Right.
It's a totally different programming language. But Unity supports C++ as well, doesn't it? Isn't there a way to do that?
I don't believe so, not unless you get a source license.
Oh, okay. And that makes sense.
Yeah, I believe it's from everything I've heard from talking to people, but I haven't done any Unity development myself. But the default stuff is just all the all their mono derivative C# stuff. That's part of their story on like having the web player and having sort of ultimate cross-platform compatibility is that gives them that powers, because it's essentially all in a language and environment that they control. That stuff just works. Whereas if you had people writing a lot of C++, I mean, there's no conceivable way it could work in the web player at any reasonable, any reasonable way at that point.
Right. C++ is a common language, but every game engine has its own libraries, its own way of doing things. C++, although it's a portable language, I don't think that's really true in sort of the game world, except for at the lowest levels.
So asking this sort of loaded question, as all three of us are Mac and iOS developers by sort of history, but so how was C#? Like the idea of writing a game in C# as a Mac developer just seems like so bizarre to my brain that when I heard that Unity used that, I was like, really?
Yeah. C#? And that's, I think that's a very common reaction. And it's exactly the reaction I had. In fact, my aversion to C# at first was so strong that I did the first couple of classes I wrote in Unity script, which is ECMA script or JavaScript. It's all, technically, I guess they're not all the same thing, but it's all essentially the same language. And that was, I think even more painful. So I think it was actually a good thing I did that first, because then when I went into C#, I was like, oh, this is kind of like a real programming language. I did not dislike it to the extent I thought I would, and there were things about it I actually liked. It's not a bad little language for, the generation of language it is, for a higher level language like that. It's not bad. It's like Java, but without some of the bad of Java. It's I was sort of pleasantly surprised as I worked with it more that it really isn't a bad little language. I don't think it would ever be my first choice, but I found myself getting into a groove with it and not being too frustrated. I mean, there were times when not being able to get down to pointers or, not be able to use certain optimizations that I'm accustomed to being able to use in a language like Objective-C, where we always have the option of dropping down to C. But, I adjusted, and I really didn't hate it at all, which if you know me, that's actually pretty high praise for a Microsoft product.
I haven't done a huge amount of C# programming, and as I said, no Unity programming. But from what I've seen of it, it seems like C# is actually a pretty good sweet spot for smaller indie kind of teams. That, C++, you're taking on a big boat anchor of a language, right? Like C++ has some great things about it, and there's good reasons why it's the key language for game development right now. But the things that C++ gives you, a game of that size probably doesn't need, right? Like that knowledge that, yeah, you can just drop down and do crazy things in the situation where that's going to give you, a 10x performance increase is something you need to have in your back pocket on like a AAA console game, but it's not something that a small story-focused indie game needs to have standing by at all times. But at the same time, if you make a call like, oh, well, we're going to do the whole game in JavaScript or some other like really high level scripting language, then you're kind of throwing away too much performance, that those scripting languages can start to become a performance boat anchor, even in relatively simple games. If you're like, oh, well, we're writing our pathfinding, like our A* is all written in JavaScript and it's 50 times slower than it would be if it was in C++ or something like that, can become a problem. So C# actually really hits a nice sweet spot there, in that it's fast enough that you don't have to worry about performance at that scale, but it's a real programming language. It's not a scripting language that's got some toy elements to it or some warts, or you're losing a lot of performance, or you're in a situation where you end up having to drop down to the underlying system language anyways to get things done in some situations because stuff isn't fully exposed to the scripting language. Like, it's, you know, I think it is actually a good call for most developers working on that scale to use instead of either C++ or a much higher level scripting language.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, and as much as like we wrote some C++ for one of the sort of 3D cross-platform apps that we did at SteamClock, and you know, and I was one of the first languages that I worked in doing games like 12 years ago. And so it has I have like a fondness in my heart for it, sort of in theory, but it's like 100,000 feet of rope to hang yourself with.
Yeah, it's, you know, and it's especially having been away from it for a while. And, you know, people complain about Objective-C, but it's, you know, it's, I know its quirks pretty well from the time I've spent in it. And C++, I'm relearning a lot of those, and there is a lot there. And of course, on top of that, Unreal has its own way of using C++, and they've got a lot of macros and, you know, a lot of stuff that is, you know, designed to sort of short circuit it for you. You don't have to type a lot of boilerplate. You just type in a macro that they provided for you, but it does make the code start looking really weird. What are all these uppercase letters here? Oh, you know, it's a little bit daunting. I certainly would not want to, as a new person trying to learn game programming, I don't think that I would want to have to deal with the baggage of C++.
Now, one question I have about that is how well does Blueprint sort of fill that niche? Like, I was a little surprised when I originally heard that they were ditching Unreal Script, which had always seemed to me like one of the sort of strengths of the Unreal Engine is having a scripting language that, that was built in all the time, but was still a real programming language to some degree, though certainly not at like, C# level of performance. But it seemed to me like kind of a weird decision to go to only C++ or only Blueprint. And I haven't had a chance yet to sort of talk with someone who's used Blueprint until now to find out, like, you know, does it fill that niche, or is Blueprint like it's a good way for an artist or a level designer to throw together a little bit of behavior, but if you want to do real work, you gotta drop down to C++ for things that maybe you could have done in Unreal Script before.
Yeah, well, I don't have any experience with the Unreal Script side of things, so I there's a limit to my ability to respond to that. But whoever was the decision maker on UE4 at the high level, I kind of have this picture of them doing kind of a poker all in thing. It's like, you know, just goodbye Kismet, goodbye Unity Script. This is what we're doing, and, you know, just pushing the big stack of chips into the center of the table. It is a pretty ballsy move. I mean, a lot of things that they've done with Unreal are pretty ballsy. I mean, dropping the price to such a ridiculous level. So I've always had, and probably from the fact that I've been exposed to a lot of visual programming languages over the years and have never liked one. I've always found them just to be onerous. I really wasn't expecting to like Blueprint at all. And I actually found myself rather liking it. It's a very, very well thought out visual system. You can see Kismet in it. I mean, there's a lot of that's similar between the two. It's also seems to borrow a lot from that's evolved on the art side of the house with the node-based compositors and node-based material systems, and it's a very, very flexible system. There is a point, however, you know, if you are doing any kind of complex algorithm, that it starts to become kind of onerous. I mean, if you look at some of the screenshots, not in my blog post, but the one that's linked to from mine, done by Thomas, who's our lead Unreal programmer. Some of the screenshots in there, those actually aren't our more complex one, and we have started converting some of that stuff over to C++ that we, you know, originally were going to try and do in right in Blueprint. So, you know, there's definitely a limit to what you can do. I don't know. I think the limit is further along the spectrum than let's just let our artist open a door. But, you know, and there's a lot of situations where complex algorithms, you know, can be avoided by using some of these other tools like behavior trees. But, you know, if you have to do something of any complexity, and you're a programmer, you know, you're probably going to find C++ is going to be, you know, the right option for a lot of more complex things. But, you know, Blueprint is capable of doing almost anything you can do in C++. I'm hesitant to say anything, but it's pretty close. And they work together. I mean, you can subclass a C++ class over in Blueprint and whatever. So it's a nice pairing. Whether there will be something in between the two at some point. Now they've got an Unreal script. There have been some rumors that are completely unverified. So I'm sort of hesitant to say them, but about a possible C# being a third option at some point in the future.
That would be interesting.
You know, they're already using it in their build system. So, you know, they've already got the mono runtime in there. So, you know, which may be what's spurring the rumors. It's not like Epic has said anything to that effect, to my knowledge. But, you know, there have been some, at least some conjecture, if not rumors, that they may be looking to fill sort of the middle ground with C#.
Yeah, what I had read about the sort of decision to stop supporting Unreal Script in favor of just making people write more C++ was that they were finding, probably more so on larger game projects, but that what would happen is the artists would ask for some new feature in Unreal Script, and then the programmers would write some C++ to expose some part of the C++, and that loop would happen over and over again, to the point that the artists had so much power in the Unreal Script world that they could create almost any performance problem or coupling or engineering problem that you could ever devise, because they're not programmers, right? So they're not like necessarily as critical about, well, if I do this, then this is going to cause a synchronization, which is going to cause us to lose like 3 milliseconds per frame. They're just like, oh, I want the thing to do this, and here's some cool cookie way of coupling together these scripts they gave me in order to make the, you know, whatever interesting thing happen in this script. So they ended up finding that it was too powerful.
I've heard exactly that sort of fear from some people with experience with the UDK when I was telling them about the Blueprint stuff. So, you know, I think that's probably true.
Certainly on big AAA kind of game projects that use a scripting language, it's not uncommon to have someone spend, you know, a couple people spend like six programmer months at the end of the project rewriting a whole bunch of the scripting code in C++. I've done that on games at Radical, the stint that I did at United Front Games working on Little Big Planet Karting a couple of years ago after we started Steam Clock, and I was sort of out of the games industry in general, but did a specific small contract there. Big bunch of what I was doing there was rewriting Lua stuff in C++, and so that's a very common trope, and I think it's still something that, I don't know that that's necessarily a point against scripting languages. Like, I think still probably most of the time it's better to be able to do the stuff in a scripting language and get it working and get it prototyping and get it tuned, and then say, all right, this particular thing isn't performing badly, let's sink some time into converting this thing that we know works into C++, rather than necessarily writing it from scratch in C++ and making it harder and more expensive to tune. But it's, you know, it's definitely not a slam dunk. It's definitely not just like, oh yeah, people are, you know, 5 times more productive in this scripting language and the artists can do stuff, so everything's better. You know, there's going to be the couple of things on each project that are going to be like, yeah, this is not performing well, and so we got to throw it out and rewrite it. And that takes a long time compared to what originally creating it did, because C++ is harder to write than your Lua or your Blueprint script or whatever.
Yeah,
that's actually a good segue to our sponsor, because you mentioned some work that we did. So I'll do that, and then I want to talk a little bit about some of the features in game engines before we wrap up. So this episode is brought to you by Steam Clock Software. Steam Clock makes beautiful apps for iOS, Android, and the web. If you're a Fortune 500, a startup, or somewhere in between, you're looking for working with a team that sweats every pixel, learn more at www.steamclock.com. And it's worth mentioning, as sort of Nigel alluded to, we do 3D work as well. So if you have an app that has some sort of 3D stuff, or sometimes even we'll work on games for various specific projects, special ops, if you need Nigel's brain, then send us an email. We've talked a fair amount about sort of various aspects of sort of programming languages and things like that. And before we wrap, I wanted to touch on a couple things about like what makes sort of a game engine sort of as far as the functional parts in it. And I became particularly curious about this looking at the screenshots for Republic Sniper that are in Unreal and seeing the difference in between the Unity ones and the Unreal ones of that same level, what do you call the, not, I won't call it Sniper Hall, but the long one. And it looked to me suddenly just like, oh, that's a modern console game, as opposed to, oh, it's like an indie sort of 3D. Like, I don't know, I want to say it looked bluer. That doesn't even make sense, but like, so what is it that, and I'm sure there's many answers to this question, it's like I'm opening a bombshell or something, but what makes an Unreal Engine look just quote-unquote like an Unreal Engine? Like I look at it and I'm like, oh, that looks Mass Effect-y. Like what gives it that feel?
Yeah, well, I mean, the engine, the engines I don't think give a huge amount most of the time. If you look at a certain generation of engine, you know, you're not going to see a huge amount of difference between, you know, the different engines. But I think, you know, in this particular case, we're basically jumping from an older style of rendering, you know, the old scanline type of rendering where the lighting calculations are essentially all cheats, to a system that's they call it physically based. You know, once you get into the physically based stuff, you're starting to get beyond my graphics programming ability. It's you know, but it's not a true full physical simulation, but it's, you know, further along the spectrum to that. So it's actually doing calculations that are more in line of how light really works in the real world, and you're defining materials or based on qualities that are sort of have parallels in the real world. You're not doing specular and you're actually doing metallicness and color, base color, and things that, you know, sort of make a little more sense to somebody who's not immersed in these cheats that we all use historically in game shaders. So, you know, for the difference, you know, there's a couple of things that play in that specific comparison that you're talking about there. One is that we were on Unity 4, which is sort of a more traditional engine where we're using diffuse maps and spec maps and normal maps, and then writing shaders to try and display it the way we want it. And then the later shot is in this new physically based rendering system, which, you know, I honestly can't even tell you a lot about how it works under the hood. I just know it's as impressive as hell when you look at it.
it looks amazing.
The other thing that's really was a huge help for us, one of the reasons why it looks so much better, you know, not to discount the amazingness of the new renderer in Unreal, but another thing has just been the workflow is so much more artist friendly that, you know, I wasn't bottlenecking them. You know, they could make all these little tweaks back and forth to get just the look they wanted, whereas, you know, in the Unity workflow, they were constantly being bottlenecked by me. They were constantly having to go through me to do things that they're now able to do themselves in the tool. So, you know, there's a lot going on in that particular situation. You know, I don't think we actually looked to Mass Effect as an inspiration, but I'm certainly going to pass that on to our artists, because I take it as a compliment, because it's one of my favorite game franchises that's come out. So you know, I think it's the two big things are that it is it's a new generation of rendering technology, and it's a much more artist friendly workflow that contributed to the difference in the screenshots.
Do you have anything to add, Nigel, about what that, you know, physically based rendering is obviously a vague term because they don't want to say it's not a complete simulation with ray tracing or everything, but like what they exactly mean by that. Because that's something that Unity 5 is now, like, which is the upcoming version of Unity, is like, no, now we have physically based rendering too. I'm like, what does that mean?
Well, and I think just in fairness there on Unity, I think they've been working on it since before Unreal announced it. One of Unity's big problems is they just never really feel to be in all that much of a rush to get stuff out the door.
I mean, essentially what physically based rendering is, and I mean, there's a couple things going on here. Like in the academic sphere, there's been a real move over the last little while, the last decade or more, like way before you could do any of this stuff in real time, to trying to model the physical properties of surfaces. So thinking about, not just what approximation can we come up with of the way that like light bounces off surface, but how do we really model things like the properties of the surface and, how subsurface scattering, where little bits of light get like inside the surface and bounce out, and light being changed by the surface that it touches. Like one of the things that's, it's not actually as clear in that particular screenshot, partially just because it's a static screenshot and those things are tough to see in that sometime. But, one thing that is definitely becoming more of a thing and that gives modern games a much more rich look than previous games is like global illumination, where you have not just that there's light sources and they're directly lighting surfaces and that's what you see, but that light is bouncing off surfaces in the world and affecting them differently. And that's something that's, that comes out of that sort of, how can we more plausibly simulate what's really going on with light rather than having these very simple approximations. The actual techniques of physically based rendering is a little outside my level of knowledge as well, because I only know it sort of from the standpoint of this stuff was starting to come in when I got out, because it wasn't really plausible yet on the previous round of consoles. And so, we were watching the graphics papers and sort of saw this stuff coming and were paying attention to it, but I've never implemented anything like a BRDF, I think it is, which is the BRDF is sort of the, it stands for, here it is, bidirectional reflectance distribution function. And basically what it is it's a more complicated equation than what you would have used previously of like, what's the diffuse color of the surface? What's the specular color of the surfaces? It's a way more based on the physics of what's happening to light in a surface way of modeling the properties of a surface. And it's something that you can actually figure out for a surface. Like you can, with the correct hardware, you can get some material in and photograph it and calculate the BRDF for that surface if you want to know how that surface responds. I don't know if people actually use that or if they've sort of figured out how to tune these things to get the results.
There's actually
they want.
Databases of those. Like you can get a database of like hundreds of materials, like exactly what it would look like, and you can see examples and then what the numbers you got to put are into the renderer.
And so from what I understand, those are kind of the, or maybe adding, pervasive shadowing in there as well, but using BRDFs to model the properties of the surface and using global illumination in some form to model transfer of light between surfaces in the scene rather than only modeling single bounce light, leaving a light source, hitting a surface, and then ending up at the eye point from that surface in some way. Those are sort of the two things that, push it over into physically based rendering as opposed to what we were doing before, which was not really physically based at all. It was very much a approximation that someone came up with that happened to look good, as opposed to, this stuff is more trying to figure out what are the real things that are going on in the world when these lighting operations are happening.
Yeah, there's one of the things that I found is one of the biggest jumps in terms of immersiveness with the new engine is also the way they capture reflections. Reflections on the older generations were always sort of a hack. You would actually usually have an image that would get reflected back out using a cube map or something. And, you know, it wasn't what was actually in the scene. So, you know, I can remember sitting in games where you'd have some kind of metal or glass thing and just sort of moving back and forth in front of it and watching and sort of watching the illusion come apart. But in Unreal 4, you actually define reflection spheres that capture parts of the scene at runtime. So, you know, if you walk up to something that's shiny and metal and you've got a, you know, it's a third person or you've got a full model of a character on a first person, you're actually going to see that's going to be contributing to both the light and the reflection that's happening. It's actually what's in the scene that's getting reflected back. The other big thing is also materials that have an emissive property, materials that emit light, actually affect the things around them. This is one of the sort of the big things in older engines, is if you have an emissive property, usually it's just a cheat. It's just brighter. It doesn't actually affect the things around it. And those are sort of two things I know that really I've noticed playing around with the example projects that they give and experimenting with our own stuff, that really sort of helped the immersiveness. And, you know, to me, it's just mind-boggling that a lot of these features are actually supported on the mobile devices. Not all of them, of course. You know, they can't do PS4 quality stuff on an iPad. But it is amazing how much they can do and how good it does look.
Yeah, those advanced things. I took some advanced graphics courses at when I was doing my degree. And one of my favorites, like all of them are always fun to me. It's like things you don't think about, the way things look, that are actually really complicated to calculate. But my favorite, as Nigel mentioned, was subsurface surface scattering, which at first I didn't understand. It's like, why is it? Okay, so light is going into this thing, is bouncing around, coming back out. But like, how do you explain to someone what that is? And then I came across an example that is what really made sense to me, which was milk is white and white paint is white, but they do not look the same.
Yeah.
And that's because the light goes into the milk and comes back out again. And then on the white paint, it just does not do that. So it doesn't look. And if you have milk, someone poured it out and it looked like white paint, you would know it was not milk. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Wax is also another thing. A white candle looks very different than like a white painted wall.
And then the thing that makes us care the most about subsurface scattering is that skin does that. So people look sort of creepy without it, unfortunately.
Yeah, and one of the powerful features of BRDFs is that they can capture some of that stuff. Subsurface scattering, I think, still needs a few other tricks layered on top of it in terms of how you figure out that there's subsurface scattering going on. But it's, you know, it's definitely something that, you know, your standard like diffuse, specular, emissive, like Phong lighting model just can't capture any of that stuff. Whereas BRDFs, BDRFs, I can never remember which one it is. BRDFs do catch those.
Yeah, and actually UE4 ships with a subsurface shader. They call it a pre-integrated, which pre-integrated skin shader, which I think means it's a cheat, but not as much of a cheat.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of this stuff is still cheats, like particularly at the game levels. Like in high-end graphics, they're really trying to solve some of these problems for real. And there's some stuff still that, you know, really high-end, like ray tracers and similar systems of that can do something that's very close to simulating the real physics of what's going on. And in games, a lot of it's still cheated, but the cheats are now, you know, getting influenced by the high-end research and starting to pull in some of these things that, like, yeah, okay, we still can't do like full bounce global illumination in real time, but BRDFs are totally within the bounds of what you can plausibly do with a you know, with modern graphics hardware. So we'll use BRDFs, but we won't run like a full global illumination solution. We'll have some, you know, some cheesy volume sampling that, like, yeah, okay, things get a little redder if they walk next to the red wall with the white light shining on it, but it's not, you know, it's not what would physically happen to a dynamic object moving past that wall. But certainly for offline calculation, you can get very close. I mean, most of the like light map baking techniques and stuff like that are doing something very close to the full solution now, I think.
One of the last things I wanted to sort of touch on was editors, which we talked a little bit about before, about like how, you know, the IDEs themselves sort of were better or worse compared to in Unity versus Unreal. But I have a particular fascination with editors because the first time Nigel and I ever worked together, like, I don't know what it was, 15 million years ago, was I did some work experience at Radical, where for a week they tasked me with adding some little features to their 3D viewer editor tool that they had for working on games, which, you know, I was like in grade 12 or something like that at the time. So that was like one of the most exciting things that had ever happened to me. I was like making these three green lines in 3D. I was like, this is amazing. I'm going to be a game developer forever, which was not exactly true. But so my understanding is that since then, the sort of editors have been more and more sort of integrated into the games. Is there anything in sort of Unreal that helps you build custom editors for your content, or is that sort of a hands-off thing?
You know, that's a good question. Obviously you have source code access, so, you know, you can do anything. We haven't used it if it's there. I don't really have a good answer to that. We're still sort of working on a lot of the basics. You know, we're making good progress, but, you know, we're still only 3 or 4 months into our conversion. So I don't know, you know, in terms of how much flexibility. I mean, obviously it's like a lot of 3D apps where the interface itself is very configurable. You can pop out new panes and new windows and move things around and customize which buttons are on the toolbar and various things like that. But in terms of actually extending it, I'm not even really sure what that looks like with UE4. I know a little bit of it over in Unity, because we did have a few, I can't even know what they're called, extensions, plugins, where we added inspectors and stuff for stuff that wasn't standard, but we haven't actually had to do that with the Unreal stuff at all. I mean, I think one of the big sort of differences we've noticed is that we really rely a lot less on third-party stuff, and a lot more of the time our needs have been anticipated by the tools that are there.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm sure if there's a way to do it in Unity to extend its stuff, I'm sure there's ways to do it in Unreal, but it's a good sign that you haven't needed to yet.
Yeah, so. It might be just a matter of going in and coding it yourself since you have access to the code, or there may be, you know, a defined SDK for doing it, and I just don't know.
Awesome. So I think that's like awesome coverage of game engines, Unreal and Unity in particular, but I think there's some good meat in there. Where can people go to find more about your work, Jeff?
All right, well, our main website is martiancraft.com, martiancraft.com, and we have a website set up for the game at republicsniper.com, although it's mostly just got a teaser trailer and a sign up for a mailing list right now, although we plan to start fleshing that out as we get closer to our release date.
All right. Well, everyone go sign up to learn about when Republic Sniper is ready. Thank you for listening. If you have any feedback or thoughts, you can either leave us a review on the iTunes store, or you can send us an email, hello@upup.fm, and see you next week. Play any good games recently?
Play any good games. It's funny. We actually most of my game playing lately has been not a new game. It's been an older game. We have a weekly 6 o'clock on Fridays. We have a company wide Team Fortress 2 match. Goes for an hour, which is always fun. And it's company wide and then also family and friends. So I have two teenage boys who, you know, come in every week and wipe the floor with the rest of us, unfortunately. I'm trying to think what I've been playing recently. One of the challenges with doing the games is a lot of our people are cross-functional, and so, you know, if there's a crunch on another project, people get pulled in. So I actually got pulled off into another project last month onto kind of a crazy time crunch, you know, 14-hour day kind of thing. I haven't really been doing too much in the game. I replayed through Deus Ex Human Revolution two, three weeks ago. What was I playing the other night? I haven't gotten a new one in quite a while.
It's surprising, but maybe not surprising, that often the people that we talk to who are the most currently involved in making a game are the people who are playing the least games.
Yeah, it's tough, and we're also in sort of that weird lull right now before, you know, all the game companies ramp up with all their new stuff for the holiday season. One of my game artists has been doing the Redux version of the Metro series. And he's been speaking very highly of that. I have intentionally not bought that one because I know I would end up being up until 3-4 in the morning for a couple of days if I did. So I haven't let myself buy that one yet. But he's been very speaking very favorably of it. It's a neat game. I like atmospheric games. Some of the games that really stick out in my head aren't the ones that had necessarily the best gameplay, but the ones where the environment was most impressive. Things like Bioshock and Bioshock Infinite, Mass Effect, like you mentioned earlier, and I think the Metro series really falls in that. It's a very real world, you know, and distinctive. You know you're in a Metro.
It's
game.
It's definitely even the non Redux version is a very visually arresting game in many ways. Like I haven't played all the way through it because I was enjoying it, but I wasn't like loving it, and I got distracted with something else. I played, I don't know, maybe like four missions or so into Last Light, it really is. It's got a very unique look, even for being like a environment in general that you've seen before, of like abandoned underground installations and post-apocalyptic future. And, you know, it's an environment that's been done to death, but they've got a very unique visual take on it, which is kind of neat.
Yes. Yeah. I enjoy it visually. Yeah. I enjoyed it visually more than I enjoyed the story or the gameplay. You know, I thought it was good all around, but you know, it was the thing that attracted me to it was the environment. That's, you know, I can still remember when Bioshock came out, that one really kind of blew me out of the water. Cause it was like, you know, you look at it now, cause it's several years later, you're like, wow, this really isn't anywhere near as good as it is in my memory. You know, cause obviously the limitations of the technology, but I mean, it was such a neat, environment, and, you know, just walking around it, you know, sometimes I would die just cause I was going around looking at statues and you know, banners and flyers and stuff. So I really like games that have a very distinctive feel and a real feeling environment, even if it's completely fantastic and unbelievable. If it feels real, I think, you know, they've done something impressive.
Well, if you miss the Bioshock world, but want to see it brought up to sort of a little more modern feeling, there's the Burial at Sea DLC, which is the Bioshock Infinite DLC that Nigel was just actually saying he played.
Yeah, I just played it this weekend. We were camping this weekend, but I don't camp. My children love camping, and I loathe everything about camping. So us camping is, you know, like taking them up there, and then I go home and just sleep in my bed at night. But what that meant is that over the weekend while they were camping, I had like 4 uninterrupted hours each evening in which to game. And so that was my project, was to play through Burial at Sea. And I quite enjoyed it. Like it's definitely a microcosm of everything that's both good and bad about the Bioshock series, that it's, you know, really fantastic environments, really great characters and voice work, really like bold narrative choices, but not always 100% successful narrative choices. But it's definitely worth playing if you're a fan of the series.
Yeah, I have actually played that. It's interesting because I don't play most of my games when they first come out. I usually pick up a whole bunch of games during the Steam sale that they do twice a year. And that's the bulk of my games. I usually don't run right out and buy the new ones. And there's a couple of exceptions to that. The Mass Effect ones, Mass Effect 2 and 3, I bought, you know, basically when they came out. And the Bioshock ones are also in that very small category of, yeah, if it comes out, I buy it. So I bought Bioshock Infinite when it came out, and then I bought all the DLC as they came out, and I really enjoyed the burial. See, I really liked part one because, you know, they I'm not sure what the right word is. I want to say kind of almost contrived, but that's more negative than I want. But they're, you know, it's almost like they try to make it sort of nonlinear and almost sort of, it's almost sort of predictable in its unpredictability. And they got me with the ending of part one. I was pretty impressed with the little twist there towards the end of part one. So I did enjoy the burial scene. I thought the second one was a little less. You know, I was really looking forward to the getting to play as Elizabeth, and I didn't find that one was quite as didn't quite rise to the level of Bioshock Infinite and the first part of the DLC.
It's definitely something that I can see it turning off some fans of the series. Like, I quite like the stealth aspects of it, but it's definitely not very Bioshock. Like, Bioshock for me has always, one of the things I like about the gameplay of it is that even though it's got these great environments and this ambitious story, it really is just kind of an old school shooter at heart. Like, even more so than, you know, the other mainstream shooters these days, like your Call of Duties and what have you. Like, it's really a bit of a throwback to, like, the Doom and Quake era in terms of its gameplay in a lot of ways. And I like that, but I also do really like stealth games. So mixing it up and having a stealth portion for me is fantastic, but I certainly would not blame any fan of the series who's turned off by that, because it's definitely a big change. And you're always running a risk with you, particularly with stealth in a non-stealth game, you know, like, Uncharted 2, I think it was, that sort of started introducing more stealthy elements to the Uncharted series. And the first couple of, like, the first game that they had the stealth missions in, which, like I said, I think was Uncharted 2, I felt like the stealth missions were just a complete blowout, you know, like they weren't really much fun because it wasn't a stealthy kind of game. And the way that the game was tuned wasn't very good for stealth. And they eventually improved it. And then, you know, when they rolled that technology over into The Last of Us, they did a lot better with it, but it was definitely rough out the gate. And I didn't feel like the stuff in Bioshock was that off-putting, but there were definitely moments where there were things that kind of broke the stealth that way. Like the big fight with Ryan's minions all of a sudden, right? Where you've been stealthing through the whole thing, and then just like these 8 or 10 totally pumped up splicers just jump you, and you got to completely relearn your strategy. It was a bit of a, you know, it's a bit of like getting the shakes, like the Deus Ex Human Revolution PTSD shakes.
Yeah, I actually really do like stealth games. In fact, the game that I could think of that I've been playing recently was Dishonored. I finished Dishonored a while back, but I realized that I must have bought it as a package where you got all the DLC. So I had all these DLC missions I had never played. So I was last week I was playing those, and I really do like stealth games. And I wasn't off put by the part two. I think part of it was I was really looking forward to it. I mean, I think I had built up my expectations, and then I it was such a change in sort of the basic gameplay mechanism for the series. I think it was just I started to play through a second time, which I don't do very often with games, and I didn't play it all the way through the second time, but I definitely was enjoying it more. I mean, I think with all stealth games, there is a learning curve. They start to become fun when you start getting good. You know, whereas a straight up shooter, they can be pretty fun. You know, you just adjust the difficulty level to match where you are, and you know, it's fun. But you know, the stealth games really don't, for me at least, they don't start to get fun until you start getting pretty good at the stealth mechanism and you know, getting a feel for how close you can get before they see you, or what things actually hide you well, or you know, it's and I didn't dislike the game at all. I found certain things about it just weren't quite, you know, it was that yes, it's an A. You got a 95, but you know, up to now you've been getting 99. So, you know, it was good. I think I had built it up a little bit more in my head, and ended up being not quite as good as I had built it up to be. Because it definitely was a good game, and you know, if they come out with another DLC, it'll be on my first release buy list, which is they said a very short list. So you know, it certainly didn't mean to give the impression that I didn't like it. I just didn't think that it was as good as the first part. I mean, the first part was short, but they got me. You know, those twists that you don't see coming are a lot of fun, and you know, I knew there was something coming, but they totally got me with what it was. So I enjoyed that.
I think with both parts, the hook at the end was definitely a shocker. I would say it was better. I felt it was more justified in part one than part two. Like the part two ending felt a little to me like they decided they had to connect everything, and this is the way that they could figure out how to do it, as opposed to something that made sense within the fiction of BioShock Infinite.
Awesome. Well, I think I should go now because I need to go download Unreal and go make a game from all the cool things we heard about.
Yeah, it's...
Which is probably a horrible idea because... can you even do 2D games in Unreal? I mean, I'm sure you can do. Does anyone even do 2D in Unreal?
Yeah, that's actually... That was on your list and we didn't cover that. So, you know, that's sort of been historically one of the sort of the weak points of the Unreal Engine from people I've talked to is, you know, when you start getting away from the first person, third person, you know, either first person shooter or third person RPG type of games, it started becoming harder and harder. And I think that with UE4, one of their focuses has been to broaden what the engine can do easily. If you look at their example content, they have a marketplace. It's kind of like the asset store, but there's not as much in it yet. It's mostly stuff that they've done. They're mostly sample projects. But if you look at the sample projects, more of them are not first person or third person than actually are. You know, they've got side scrollers and platformers, and there's card games. There's a blackjack game in there. So you know, it does seem to be a focus of theirs, and you know, it's definitely is possible. But I don't think there's much that has shipped that's 2D or 2.5D or fake 2D, you know, 3D just done with an orthographic camera. So I don't think there's a lot that's actually shipped there, but it definitely looks like it's part of a focus of theirs, and they want it to be good for that. We haven't tried to use it for that, so I can't really say how well they've done.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, for anyone who does not yet know, doing a 3D game, even if it's in a 2D plane, like a 2D sort of platforming game, but it has 3D assets just rendered in 3D, which is the way they do a lot of those games now, just dramatically increases the total amount of work so much that you do need a, you know, at least a medium-sized team like you have over there at Martian Craft, that you can have people who are just full-time people making 3D art. You can't, like, if I'm going to do a hobby game in evenings and weekends, then it really needs to be 2D and not fake 2D, but I'm making photo. I can do Photoshop. I can make a sprite, but a 3D model is just, even if you're good, it's time consuming.
Yeah. So. Well, it does. I mean, it does support sort of a true 2D, even though you're actually always working in a 3D virtual space. You know, one of their samples is sort of this little ninja game where it's almost looks like cutout paper. And so, you know, you definitely can do it. I can't speak to, you know, how much work it is. But, you know, Unity actually, the push towards actual, you know, built-in 2D tools is actually relatively recent. There have been a lot of third-party add-ons that made that process easier, but the actual official supported 2D game templates and stuff, I think, only came out in like 4.3. So, you know, it's actually a relatively new thing, but they're, because of the asset marketplace and all the, you know, there's just a huge amount of content out there. Some good, fair amount, not so good, but, you know, there were a lot of good libraries for doing 2D work.
Yeah, so far I've been playing in the last couple of weeks with SpriteKit, which is sort of iOS and Mac only, but for my needs and for my friends and colleagues who may actually play the game, as long as it's a hobby game, then that's helpful. But if I ever wanted to say, oh, I want to like try to submit this to a game jam, or, you know, maybe we're like, oh, this is fun enough that we want to turn it into a Steam Clock project and actually publish it with some seriousness, then in order to get your money back or your investment back, then you want to try to have as many platforms as possible. And that's why I've been at least sort of thinking about, is SpriteKit the best thing to be investing my time in?
Yeah, SpriteKit and SceneKit, both of them really have leapt forward in the last couple of releases, and I would love to spend more time in them, but as a practical matter, you know, something like Unity or Unreal, you know, just gives you that that support for multiple platforms, and, you know, Apple's never going to do that. Apple has no interest in helping, you know, people ship Android apps or ship desktop apps for PCs or console apps. You know, it's just, that's not their focus. It's never going to be, and it's unfortunate because it's a nice technology. I like SpriteKit a lot, but I don't think we would ever consider it even for the 2D games that we have another sort of a Skunkworks 2D game project right now that we're using Unity for, and we talked about using SpriteKit. We even considered doing it in SpriteKit, but you know, when it comes down to it, that flexibility of being able to port to other platforms easily really goes a long way.
SpriteKit's pretty great, though.
It is.
It's so simple, and it's just...
It's a really nice piece of engineering. They did a really nice job on it. It's just, you know, as a practical business concern, you know, the fact that it is tied to a single platform is a tough obstacle to overcome.
On the other hand, I mean, sometimes you get the best results out of tying yourself to a single platform. It's always the, you know, it's always the console exclusives that look the best. It's a riskier game to play because you don't spread your risk out across multiple platforms and multiple potential revenue streams, right? You gotta be an enormous hit on your platform of choice to do that. But you know, when you do it well, you end up with stuff like The Last of Us, which is just way more visually arresting than almost anything else out there on the other platforms, in part because they only have to make it work on one piece of hardware.
Yeah, that's actually one that's on my list. I don't have a PS3 or a PS4, so for me to play that game, it's a several hundred dollar investment, so I haven't done it yet, but I've heard so many good things from so many people.
There's not many games that I would say are worth a $300-$400 investment just to play the game, but if you had to pick one or two that are, I think Last of Us would be near the top of that list.
Yeah, it's on my list of, gosh, I really had a console, you know, and it's the thing that, like, if I do get a console and one of the new generation consoles anytime soon, it's probably going to be the thing that steers me over to the Sony side instead of the Xbox side.
You have to do it. it's
that good, huh? Well, yeah.
I mean, it's not like it's going to change your life, but... Like, if anyone pushes to say, what's your favorite game, then I would say Last of Us. And the fact that you have the opportunity to play it on the PS4 and you get the remastered one, which is presumably some percentage better.
I've heard it's pretty amazing. Actually, I was looking at that was over in Best Buy the other day, and I was actually looking at it longingly, like, maybe I can't get this right now. I don't have time to get it.
I would say, especially for you, when you were saying that it's sort of the immersion and the world that you're in, is really what gets you. If you like games like Bioshock Infinite for that, then you will like Naughty Dog games because they spend a ridiculous amount of time on that.
I do. I very much like rich story and rich environments. I'm going to have to get it at some point. It's just a matter of when. It's probably what I'll probably do is wait for the holidays when I have some time off and I can really sit down and focus on it and not have to worry about, you know, can I stay up an extra hour?